Samicipatipanno Bhagavato Savakasangho Yatitam Chattari Purisa Yugani Atta Purisa Pugala Esa Bhagavato Savakasangho Ahuneyo Pahuneyo Dakineyo Anjalikaraniyo Anuttaran Punyaketang Lokasa Tamahan Sangang Abhipujayami Tamahan Sangang Sirasanamami. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be happy, whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born. May all beings be happy. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Oops. The questions, the never-ending questions. Anyway, one day, why the Buddha didn't want to teach just after he was got enlightened? It's not he didn't want to teach, but he did not want to teach. In other words, there was no wanting at all. So there was nothing to motivate. So we're just sitting there. It wasn't just any negativity, nor any inclination to teach. It was just nothing moving, nothing happening. Which is one of the reasons, one to understand, sometimes when you get into a deep meditation, sometimes you can't move. It's not you don't want to move, not you do want to move. Just the wanting and not wanting are totally absent. The will, it's gone. So you can imagine that was what was happening until Brahma Sahampati. And sometimes people think, why do they call it Brahma Sahampati? Because Brahma is supposed to be like a god. And Brahma Sahampati just came and asked the Buddha to teach. And if the, saying, there are beings with little dust in their eyes. Please teach out of compassion. And the last time that I went to Bangkok, to Samphan, to give a retreat, it was extremely dusty, very highly polluted. So I thought I shouldn't go, because all the beings had lots of dust in their eyes. But fortunately it cleared before I got there. And so, but anyway, that because of that, that somebody just asked. You may compare it to like a big body of snow in the mountains, and everything is just finely balanced, and all it needs is a slight sound and the avalanche begins. Everything is just in this very unstable equilibrium. The Dhamma is there, ready to be taught, but unless somebody asks, it won't happen. So that's why, as one person said many years ago, he put it very beautifully, if it wasn't for Brahma Sahampati, then there would be no Buddha. He would have been a Pajeka Buddha, a silent Buddha. So he said, quite unforgettably, thank God for Buddhism. For Brahma Sahampati. But the point was, it wasn't a god. Sahampati, just like Gatikara, was an anagami, and who was also, he wasn't from the same village as Jyotipala, but he was a same, he was a disciple under Kassapu as well. So Sahampati was another disciple of the previous Buddha Kassapa, who managed the anagami, reborn in the Sudhavasa, and when saw his old friend Siddhartha Gautama, or Jyotipala, became a Buddha, came to congratulate him and also to ask him to teach. It's in the Tamil Buddhism Sutta. It's very well known. So that's how Buddhism started. Devachampara. Does the lighting of the surrounding affect the meditation? Meditating outside daytime and meditating with bright light at night. Meditating inside during the day with dim lights at night. Meditating eyes covered and meditating in the dark at night. Is one option better than the other, or is it the same? Please clarify. That sometimes the monks or the nuns in the time of the Buddha would use their perception so it looked like daytime but it was night, or they looked like it was night and it was daytime. So it really doesn't matter your perception. Sometimes you may believe or think, oh, it's very light outside, and that means that, I don't know, that you can see where things are going, other people can see you, that sometimes dark is better, I'm not sure. So I know that usually, it's weird, but most people seem to get enlightened around dawn. Which is one of the reasons why anybody doesn't get up early enough for the morning chanting. Forget it. But know that sometimes that it really does not matter. When you've got your eyes closed, it doesn't matter whether it's dawn or whether it's the middle of the day or whatever. It's usually that usually people like the dark. I like the dark or being inside in a cave, being in some sort of seclusion, because it just gives me the idea of like just being inside something and not being able to be seen by people or by things. It makes it, you know, a bit easier, in my opinion, when it's nice and dark. However, it doesn't really matter. Sometimes we have the eye shades. And apparently in the United States they don't call them eye shades, they call them iPads. So sometimes a bit cheeky sometimes. One of the monks, I said, oh, you know, we've just been offered a lot of iPads. Do you want an iPad? He said, oh yeah, is it a new one? What sort of apps has it got on it? And I said, it's only from Singapore Airlines, covers your eyes. He was very disappointed. But anyway, just whatever works for you. Sometimes people prefer even that the full moon. I don't know what about the full moon. Sometimes it's like magic is a soft light. And maybe it is because of those times that, you know, the Buddha, you know, became enlightened on the full moon day. Sometimes a full moon day is like Vaisak or start of the rains. It has a sort of energy to it. I think it's just what we add to that energy. But nevertheless, you know, that whatever works for you, then you know, you can get very inspired sometimes on a full moon day. What do you think about meditation on skeleton or bones? I prefer to meditate on a cushion. Please, sometimes I can't resist. I think about meditating on the skeleton or on the bones. Sometimes I do it visualizing my bones for 15 to 20 minutes at the start of a sitting to settle the mind before switching to breath meditation. Any advice? Thank you. Yes, it's people like to meditate on bones or on, I don't know why, but the skull seems to be a very easy thing to meditate on. Maybe it's a little bit more complicated, maybe bones, you don't really know what's human bones, what's animal bones. But nevertheless, the skull is like something which many people find it reasonably easy to meditate on. It's something which maybe is culturally weird, and that makes it a bit more fascinating for you. So it gives you that first little bit of drawing you in so you can watch that object without any force or without any fear. It can, you know, draws you in. This is interesting. But then what usually happens, you know, if the meditation goes well, is, you know, the skull or, you know, the bones become really beautiful. And then it becomes almost like fluorescent or like an emitter, which is, you know, the usual procedure of meditation objects when one does watching the bones. And the reason is because you see the bones or you see a skull, and that's this human body which we invest so much attention and so much time and so much anxiety in. And sometimes you wonder, just we feed the body, we take it to the dentist, we take it to the doctor, we clothe it, we worry about it, we exercise it, we just wash it, we rest it, and it all ends up in the same way, just a bunch of bones. And so a lot of time it does take away many of our worries and concerns and anxieties about the future. Just a bunch of bones, that's all. And which is one of the reasons why it's going to be a bunch of bones sooner or later. So why am I worried so much or concerned so much, or you know, trying to plan all these things or do all these things, and when it's just going to be a bunch of bones? And when you reflect like that, that your attachments to the world, your cravings to the world, your worries, the busyness in a world, you know, it doesn't matter sort of how hard you work, what you own, in the end you're just a bunch of bones. And so because of that, then it's much easier to let go and to renounce and not be so concerned about the five sense world, which means that you become still. And as you become still, as I've been saying, the energy leaves the doer and goes into the knower, the mind becomes brighter, and you see the skull as a citta sankhara, as an object of the mind. And just like I've been saying a lot about, so much stuff becomes beautiful in that stage of meditation. Anything is beautiful. And this is one of the reasons why the skull becomes brilliant, beautiful. So it becomes like a white, a deeper white, an incredibly beautiful white, more white than white, and then it becomes an imitus. So that's just how often you do bones and skeleton meditation. So anyway, you can do that to settle the mind, but you don't have to. If it's, you know, just useful for you, great. If we are not to get caught up in what others think of us, then can this lead to arrogance? No, arrogance is getting caught up with what you think of you. So what other people think of you, what, you know, you think of yourself, both of those is gomayang. It is just impossible to judge accurately. You only see what you want to see, and you change so much. You know, what are you actually thinking of you? You know, sometimes, you know, you appear like one way, sometimes another way. You've got so many different personalities in there, and I love that sometimes, not always, that, you know, I can go incognito when I'm on the aircraft, or you go sort of incognito when you're at a conference. So you just go to that conference, and you don't do anything sort of naughty or bad, but instead of always being the monk in the front, you know that I would like opening doors for you if I possibly can, just because I get fed up with being served like I'm the Her Majesty the Queen or something else. And so it's nice to sort of be a bit simple sometimes. And so what was that one time when I was helped building? It was not that long ago, mixing concrete, getting all of this muck, actually I used to call it, no, mud, all this cement paste all over me, and just looking really, really unkempt and dirty. And I was on my way to the showers to get cleaned up, and on the way I met this visitor, and she was a very, obviously quite wealthy, high class, it happened to be a Sri Lankan woman. And she was so high, so well dressed, and she didn't know me, but she heard of me. And she said, I've come here to see the monk Ajahn Brahm. Do you know where he is? And you know, give me a chance like that, I'll have fun. And I said, well, if you know, I don't lie. I just said, well, if you go down to the dining room, he'll probably be there in about 10 or 15 minutes. So I just went back to my room, showered, changed, went to see her. And, you know, she didn't recognize me. Because she said afterwards, oh, it was a wonderful talk, you've got a wonderful monastery, I have to go now, but if you don't mind, one little criticism. He said, on the way here, I saw one of your monks who was very badly dressed. And it's not very inspiring to see a monk badly dressed like that, all dirty with cement stains all over him. And she never realized it was the same monk. And so, you know, just not letting know exactly we were the same, because it's not the same anyway, because, you know, who are you? You always say that as we go from day to day, life to life, not the same, not different. You know, we're not the same every moment, let alone every day. And so I told her, oh yeah, you know, okay, I'll tell that monk later on. Well, thank you very much. And then she left. So that sometimes you have a bit of fun that way. But, you know, you're not just what other people think of you. They think all sorts of things of me. Some good things, some bad things. So, some who knows things. So, of course, people think all sorts of stuff. But, anyway, that's what they think of you. It's not what you think of you. What about Hiri Otapa? Yeah, Hiri Otapa is to make sure that, you know, whatever you say and whatever you do is going to be something which is useful for you in the path. So you think, no, sometimes you think, what did I do that for? That's a silly thing to say. So that you get some sense of a little bit of remorse. Yeah, that was a mistake. But Hiri Otapa is not like guilt and punishment. So if you do make a mistake, you know straight away. If you are ashamed and have fear, and it's only you know what you've said and what you've done, no one else can judge it, why you did that, why you said that. It's up to you to make that moral judgment of your behavior. Some other people think that, you know, what you did and what you said was immoral. But, you know, it's up to you to find out if it was ethical or not. You feel that. No one else can. And so, because of that, I was just trying to think of shame, Hiri Otapa. Okay, there was times when, I was coming back from town, and I think it was a Saturday night, and if anyone had taken a photograph of me, they would have seen me carrying this beautiful woman in my arms. Do you know that story? Because as we were coming back later, it was a talk, interesting talk, it was on the Psychic Research Association. The mediums and psychics and all sorts of interesting stuff. And anyway, having given a talk there, coming back down the Albany Highway in Victoria Park, the car in front of us had a crash. And it was three girls who were going out for the night. So we were coming back sort of, you know, reasonably early. And so we were behind them. And so that, you know, we stopped the car. And just, I helped just, not carrying the arms, but just get her down to the verge outside for safety. And so sometimes that if somebody had seen me, said, yeah, what would you do that for? They could have judged me for that, but for me it was actually helping someone who could have been badly injured. And that's, of course, important for me to do that. So, and as for Hiri Otapa apply to modern society, how it applies to modern society is that, you know, we have to, you know, not, well, maybe other people don't know what we do, but we always know what we do. So because of that, what's the Hiri Otapa story? Okay, this is the one which I was trying to find in the back of my mind. This was an old story from India many, many years ago. And in those days, that people would go to one teacher, and that teacher would teach them everything. And this particular teacher, okay, it's a bit old-fashioned, even sexist or whatever, I don't know, but he had a beautiful daughter. There's always a beautiful daughter in there somewhere in these stories, and all these lustful young men. And so one day the teacher said, you know, my daughter's getting to marriageable age, and according to tradition, I have to marry her to one of you. Me. Because they all liked her. And so he said, well, the only way I can decide is to give you a test of obedience. And also, I have another problem. I'm very poor. So in order to be able to solve both my problems, for the next week, I want you to go into the local village at night time, late at night, even better, and creep into the houses and steal whatever you can. But make sure that no one sees you steal. And then bring it back, and I will actually just keep a record of what is stolen, and the one who steals the most over 7 days will win my daughter, and they will take all of the proceeds to actually to buy themselves a house and get them started in life. And all these students thought, this is crazy. The teacher was always very, very good and very moral and wise. Now he's asking us to steal. He said, this is a test of your obedience. So they thought about it and said, okay. So they went into the village and they all stole. They stole a lot of stuff. And after 7 days, the teacher sort of brought them all together. He said, you all stolen a lot of things. Enough now that, you know, whoever sort of marries my daughter using all this stuff, they're going to have a very good start in life. You've all stolen a lot, except for one of you. Why? And of course, you know, you're all smart enough to know that he would eventually be the one who marries the girl. Why? He said. And he said, well, I couldn't. He said, why? Are you disobedient? And the young man said, I was very obedient. I went into the village late at night, and I crept into the houses, and I couldn't see anyone around, and I saw valuable things, and I went in to pick them up, but before I could pick them up, somebody saw me. And the teacher said, who saw you? And the student said, I saw me. I saw me pick things up, about to pick things up, therefore I couldn't follow your instructions. I was obedient. Sadhu, 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 said the teacher. At least I have one wise, smart disciple after teaching all these people all these years. At least one person understands. Now, he said, you can take all the stuff back. I'm rich enough. And the villagers, they won't harm you because they were in on this from the start. I told them all about you. They were expecting you, which is why, you know, no one saw you because they knew you were coming. So take it all back. And this guy, who is very obedient but very wiser than all of you, knowing that whatever you do, the police may not see you, your teacher may not see you, your wife may not see you, but you see you. And that is where Hiriyotapa starts from. It's not worth it. You feel bad about yourself. Dear Ajahn, there are some books related to the ascetics in the Himalayan range, whereby those hermits are in deep meditation state and they live for more than 100 years of age or more. Some even blend their body with the trees. How do we prevent ourselves from falling into this kind of meditative state? You can't even sit still for half an hour. without falling asleep. So number one has to be in the Himalayas where it's cold, because you need the cold, like putting yourself in the freezer, to preserve your body. If you put it down here and you get sort of there, well, what happened to you? You probably get eaten up by something or other. The ants will probably get you. Or those little millipedes will probably crawl into your ears and out your nose. That should stop you messing around like that. No, sometimes those books, sometimes the ascetics in the Himalaya range where they're in a deep meditative state, the deep meditative states, they do exist, but a lot of times some of it is a little bit of wishful thinking and a little bit of exaggeration. And a little bit, because what do you want to do that for? Hermits in deep meditation states, and they live for more than 100 years of age or more in the meditative state. I do have a wonderful little inspiring photo on my shrine over in my office in Bodhinyana. And that was of a monk who was found in a cave in the north of Thailand. And he was obviously, they knew he was dead, but he was sitting in a full lotus position. And his skin had dried, so he could actually, but you know, there was no flesh on it at all. His bones were still there. He was erect. And he must have been dead a long time. They just had some fragments of robe which were on the ground next to him. And in those days, until recently, when monks would go into the forests in the caves in the north of Thailand, they would always check in with the head monk of the district. And that was actually their rules before they go off into the jungles. And so the head monk of the district was really old. He knew nothing about this monk, which meant he must have been there for at least 40, 50 years. And he was just dead, sitting there. And it must have been a long, long time. Perfect posture. And sitting there. And just, obviously in a deep samadhi, and just everything had just rotted away after a while. So if you try that in tropical climes, or even subtropical climes, you're not going to last that long. So it may work in the Himalayas, in the deep freezer of the Himalayas, but I don't know about here. And anyway, come on, be real. You're going to fall into that state? There's many other more likely things to worry about. Dear Ajahn, what is the main feature difference between the Arupa states and the Jhana states? And again, my goodness me, just going right to the deep parts instead of just, you know, the ordinary parts. But if you want to know, the jhana states are the states of where the mind becomes very still, and but still keeping all of the knower, the mindfulness, really strong. And the peak of mindfulness, the biggest strength, is in the fourth jhana. But very calm, very peaceful. What happens when things become peaceful and still? They start to disappear. It's so still that the screensaver turns off and everything starts to disappear. The Arupa states are where the mind starts to shut down, disappearing little by little by little. It's a place where you literally lose your mind, but in a good way. Dear Ajahn Brahm, thanks for always answering my silly questions. Actually, I think she'll make an exception tonight. And not, would that be a good idea not to answer a silly question? Then it can't be always, because otherwise I'm going against Anicca. But maybe this time make an exception. In Asia, and I believe hospitals, cemetery have negative energy. So when passing those places, I read Namo Tassa. What Pirita should we read? Will the Pirita calm down those beings or actually calm down ourselves? Or do we need, or we don't need to do anything, or thanks again? It is, again, in hospitals or cemeteries, places where there are dead people, it's negative energies that sometimes when I went on my wanderings to Danga, and you said, you know, took leave of Ajahn Chah, get permission, that was his advice. He said, if you want to have a peaceful afternoon or evening, go to the cemeteries, the burning ground, and you put your mosquito net umbrella, put it there, because otherwise the villagers will come and bother you. The ghosts won't bother you, the villagers would. And so, you know, because of that, what Paritta should we read? Why do you want to read? A Paritta is a protection. You have far more energy than any spirit or ghost. I'm just being serious now. This is not silly questions or silly answers. Because sometimes that an elephant is afraid of a mouse. I've never actually seen that happen, but apparently if an elephant sees a mouse, they get quite concerned. But can a mouse kill an elephant? Can an elephant kill a mouse? And that mouse is gone. So it's so easy for an elephant to kill a mouse, but not the other way around. But still, elephants are afraid of mice. You are a much higher being than any ghost. You can have a look in just the traditional just levels of beings. And human beings are very high birth. And all those beings in a high birth, you know, you are, you know, you're practicing Buddhists, you actually keep precepts, you know, you do dana, you know, you have immense power compared to ghosts. So if ever a ghost comes, they just want some help from you. They can't harm you. They just want some assistance, if possible. And so because of that, you should never sort of be afraid of ghosts, no more than an elephant should be afraid of a little mouse. So that is one of the reasons why you don't really need to chant Paritta to protect yourself. You're already very, very protected. And that I've already mentioned that the first Buddhist, you know, I ever met in this life, you know, I was at our little fair to get people to join in all the different societies at Cambridge University. And the person who was on the stall for the Cambridge University Buddhist Society, and that was my mate Bernard, first time I met him. And he was a fellow, lifelong friends, and he was a fellow who was a student of Professor Stephen Hawkins, you know, a close student, you know, who's featured in the movie, The Theory of Everything. And so he told me he had to go on the red carpet in Leicester Square for the premiere. You know, it was the only time he's ever done things like that. He was just a student, just a physicist, but, you know, he was very close to Stephen Hawkins. And he was also a Buddhist, and he was also into psychic research. In other words, they're using the scientific skills, and this is like, you know, really hard science, being a theoretical physicist, to investigate hauntings and ghosts and supernatural phenomena. And so these weren't crazy people. And so, you know, we used to go hunting ghosts, you know, when we were students. Didn't find any, but, you know, it was just, you know, a couple of stuff. I don't think we could stay quiet enough, you know, students. But anyway, you know, he did much more of that ghost hunting as a young man. And he also was said that in the journals of the London Society for Psychic Research, which, you know, had its 100th anniversary, I think, just when I was a student, so it's about 150 years old now, And these aren't sort of crazy people. These are top scientists who want to actually investigate. Is there anything to this? And you know, he was saying that just in all those years, a ghost has never hurt anybody. He notices in England, UK, and Scotland, and Wales, and Ireland. But the ghost can make you scared, but can't hurt. There's never been one case of a ghost hurting a human being. And I remember this, the fellow who was leading the group, Dr. Tony Cornell, that he was told me that there'd been many places, and I don't know why eggs and plates and stuff were flying through the air. From ghosts. But they would never hit anybody. They'd always actually go past your ear. The knife would go over your head, but it would never hit anybody. He said it's one of the weird, no one knows why, but it would never harm anybody at all. Just make you scared, that's all. And so because of that, you don't need to be scared. They're just asking for some help, cries for attention or whatever. But anyway, so if you do ever come across sort of a spirit, most of it is just your imagination, but if there really is one, then just give it loving kindness, share merits with it, so you can help it and care for it. And that means that that ghost will actually look after you. Most of the real ghost stories which I know are just so beautiful. They're lovely ghost stories. I think I mentioned that one about good old, I don't mind mentioning his name now, Peter Sales. He was the one who was over just around the corner from Nolamara Temple in Nala Way. And that's where you go on arms round there every week and Saturday when we're there, go past. But he's moved to Tasmania a long time ago. Living in the house by himself, middle of the night, waking up and just turning on the light by his bed, and on the end of his bed was his mum. His mother lived in England, and there she was, a ghost. And it's the only time he said he's ever seen a ghost, a real ghost, his mother, standing clear, not so some hazy imagination or seeing it in a mirror, seeing it really clear, just like Ananda is sitting in front of me now. You better just be careful, you better. But no, it was the image was just as if she was there. And she was smiling at him. He told the story and he could see that he felt so blessed, so privileged, so grateful, because he knew his mother must have died. And his mother had come to see him one last time. And she was just silently smiling at him, just expressing a mother's love for her child, even though he's in his 40s or 45, 50. One last time. He said one of the most beautiful experiences, about 4, 5, 6 minutes, not just for a couple of seconds, but a long time, silently just expressing their love towards one another, a mother and their son. And after that long period of time, which they would have loved to go on longer, just he faded away. Just faded, disappeared. And of course he wasn't scared at all, but he couldn't go back to bed. So he got up and did what I always say an English man would do. Made himself a cup of tea. I don't know why they do that. Any emergency, anything. Just what to do, what should we do? Oh, okay, make a cup of tea. And so that he's drinking his tea, and that's when the telephone rang. And it was his sister from Essex. Pete, I got some bad news. Yeah, Mum's dead. And the way he said it, apparently, and just the peace which he had, his sister was just so dumbfounded. Yes, I've just seen her. She came to visit me. and just there wasn't any scary fear or anything. It was just, what a wonderful gift that was. And people who've lost their loved ones think, if only that could have happened to me one last time, to see the loved one, you know, who may have died in another country or another place. They just come and just quiet. You don't need, afraid, but just beautiful. A beautiful gift of one last time. So those stories, you don't have to be afraid of ghosts. They're very, especially if it's your loved one, you're not afraid of them in this life. You don't need to be afraid of them in the next life. So that means you can just enjoy their company one last time. Realizing or not. Realizing or not, often I judge a person by his or her cover. How can I overcome this? I know we need to have loving kindness for all beings equally, but what is a practical solution? Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Or when we realize judging a person by their cover, should we rationalize not doing that? Oh, sometimes you'd make a mistake. But remember, mistakes are not to be hidden. Mistakes are to be learned from. So if you do make a mistake, I already mentioned to you that I made that mistake. I make mistakes a lot of the time, and you have some really good fun making mistakes, because I tell everyone about them. Just like the time when I was doing a funeral service for a disciple, and this particular, there's many jokes here, that this is not doing the wrong chanting for the marriage. That was something else. I did a marriage once and I was tired and I did the funeral chanting by mistake. I never told them. And you know, they're still married. It's amazing, isn't it? So much for the chanting. But anyway, there was a young man, I forget exactly who he was now, but the funeral was in Rockaby Road in Subiaco. I remember that. And I never really asked, it was one of his parents. And I never actually asked which one it was. So I knew the fellow's name, and sort of I said, I was the MC, and said, we're here just to do the funeral service according to Buddhist traditions for this gentleman's mother who's passed away. It was a 50-50 chance. And I got it wrong. Because what happened next? This old woman, sitting in the front, she stood up. It's not me who's dead, it's my husband. And the way she said it could only happen when someone's been married a long time. That was so funny. And, okay, sorry, your mum. Your father, not your mum or whatever. So you do make mistakes like that. But that's actually where you learn. Really don't, again, judge. You do judge and you make mistakes all the time. So that's why that sometimes you just leave that alone. So you learn from mistakes. And if you do make mistakes, tell everybody that when you misjudge somebody. The other night, you didn't really answer the question, exactly, about how you train your monks. Okay, so you don't shout at them, but you do mention telling monks anagarikas off. It's part of your job. What type of actions merit a telling off in your book? What else do you do to train them? You seem successful in producing good and kind monks, albeit a bit sloppy. Chip off the old block. So I'm curious as your method. Thank you to you and your monks and the nuns for creating this marvelous retreat center and teaching here. So how are you trained? One of the things which I notice is the monks and especially the monks, but the nuns as well, once they want to become a monk here, they have to sacrifice a lot. It's very difficult being a monk in Western countries. One of the reasons is, if you're in Thailand, you're given automatic respect. But, here in Australia, they get a job, you bludger, you lazy, bald-headed, whatever. Sometimes people actually, they criticise you. And so it's not the same as getting respect wherever you go. as a monk, and sometimes that if you get sick and you go to hospital, and they say, where's your pajamas? I ain't got any. So there's lots of difficulties that, you know, when you're a monk. Or there was one monk I was taking to the airport years ago, and it's in economy class, and I said, oh, would you mind just getting a seat next to a man? And the person on the check-in counter, she looked at me, what's wrong with women? We're not dirty, we're not sort of infectious. So, okay, okay, just anywhere will do. And, you know, in Thailand, it's the opposite. They always say, you must sit here, sit there. So you have some fun and difficulties being a monk, but what you know is that if you are a monk in this place, that you have already got a lot of motivation. You've had to jump over a lot of hoops, you know, especially to become a nun here. And so there's automatic respect. There's already just a filter system. Anybody who just wants an easy life, who just, you know, just wants to relax and just, you know, sleep all day, it's almost impossible to do that as a monk in the West. It's hard work. And we're still sort of, you know, always doing building and stuff. And I lead by example in the sense that I always sort of do hard work, even though it's time I should retire. But, and you know, sometimes you like to set an example of just, you know, giving and working hard, trying to live simply. So it is tough, but you train the monks a lot of time through inspiration, not by telling them off. Because if you tell somebody off, you know, sometimes I look, maybe I did that when I was a young monk. And it's the inspiration and the teachings and the uplift, that is why, you see, the people want to be a monk. They want to be a good monk. They get inspired. And those, you know, who just don't fit in, they're the ones who will leave anyway. You don't need to sort of chase them out. Just, it's not the right place for them. And they realize that. So because of that, it's pretty easy to teach monks and nuns here. They just need some encouragement. And of course, you all know, some of you asked that in the interviews, that we all have fault-finding mind. We worry what other people think of us. And that's one of the biggest problems for monks and nuns. You think, oh, you're sitting up here, you know, you're not Ajahn Brahm, he's been a monk a long time, and you know that, you know, they look at me, they look at you, and you're just all tired and sleepy, and just, you know, so you have to really sit up there and spend many hours up here, even though you don't want to, because, you know, you just, otherwise you think you're not good enough, and you're just eating the food here, and you're not really contributing, and I'm not good enough, and I can't be like these monks, or Ajahn Brahm, I can't be like Ajahn Brahm, I'm hopeless, I'm useless, and I'm sure everybody sees me, I'm sure they know what I'm thinking inside my mind, which is not the Four Noble Truths or Eightfold Path, it's something totally different. And, oh, there's a lot of people actually, just, please just encourage them. So you don't have to be perfect as a nun. You don't have to be perfect as a young monk. Just, you know, you're learning and you're growing. And so just, you know, we give you that leeway. It's one of the reasons why we have a group over in Armidale, our Armidale group, and we tell them, but that's actually just only a small group, a very sort of 20, 30, 40 people. And we go there because that's where monks can learn. Just young monks, they go there and, oh, sometimes they don't get it right first time, they make mistakes. But I think the group over there, they actually quite love that. They know, see the monks just coming up, young monks, and some don't make it, some do make it. But actually they're almost like a training ground. And they think it's quite cute there. So anyway, those are nice places, and so our monks and our nuns, we train them, but we don't sort of tell them off. We actually, I praise their good qualities. It's the old simple saying, you water the flowers, you don't water the weeds. And little by little they get encouraged, and all the silly things they've done, their idiosyncrasies, instead of trying to get them out of their character, they're actually they're the beautiful parts of their character, the two bad bricks in the wall, which makes the wall just individual and gorgeous and beautiful. So that's why you don't try and make everyone perfect. Ajahn Brahm, if a lay person has feeling, love to a novice monk or nun, he or she is in the process to be ordained.
This is weird.
Should the lay person say the feeling to him or her or keep quiet? Would it be bad karma for a lay person causing someone not becoming monk or nun? Thanks with metta. Okay, so I'm not quite sure what this is, but look. If you fall in love with a monk or a nun, forget it. They're not going to be, you know, going to leave and just join with you. And it's also the case that something which I've noticed over all these years as a monk, you know, if there's any like girl in the sort of the audience or comes to Nolamara Center, if they really sort of, you know, got like a crush on you, as they used to say, then maybe the other monks don't see it, but the other women do. They know straight away that somebody's after him. And that's amazing, just, you know, I don't know how you do it. But, you know, they say, oh, better be careful of that person that's just after him. But a lot of times, you just keep it nice and open and just... I mean, the last time I was just telling, and it is true that if you are an ex-monk, you make really good husbands. And so many times, you know, when I've done marriage services, and it's one of the old monks who'd become a monk, and the parents, you know, come up and say, oh, thank you. Actually, more like the wife comes up and says, oh, thank you for training my husband. Because imagine, that's what they learn in a monastery. They learn how to clean and to cook and to wash up and do all these wonderful duties. And imagine that on your CV, you know, when you sort of, you know, you sort of go out with someone. What did you do before? I was in a monastery and just, you know, I cleaned and learned how to cook and do all these things, which these days, you know, the kids these days, their mother does all of that for them, but now they actually learn themselves. And they're also very kind and peaceful, and they learn, you know, just, you know, of the senior monks or the senior nuns, how to look after them and do service for them. So once you're married, they do service for you, maybe, if you're lucky. So when I was saying that, you know, there's some truth to that. And then this woman came up and said, oh, Ajahn Brahm, just if ever you, you know, think of leaving, could you actually, you know, here's my telephone number. Please contact me first, she said. So, what, of course, I tell everybody about that. So no one dares do that, otherwise they'd be embarrassed. So no, just anyway. So if you have feelings of, a lot of times it's that syndrome that, you know, that people fall in love with prisoners on death row. So we're just the same in monasteries. So we're not going to leave. But sometimes we feel like it's like a fantasy, a sort of a safe romance, because you know it's never going to come to anything. So you can fantasize without the danger of your fantasy actually coming real. Because that's what happens. Many times when fantasies come real, it's not what you expected. So it's much, much worse. Anyway, does the metta spread to the whole universe? Is the same and equal to the boundless, immeasurable metta? I suppose they're the same. Which is the more exalted? Please explain. Well, it's a bit too difficult for me. When you spread metta to the whole universe, and boundless immeasurable metta, and the difference between the two is just so small if it exists at all. So it is, you experiment. You do it to the whole universe and the whole immeasurable, and once you've done that, you won't need to ask any questions anymore because you're blissed out, and questions can't live in such bliss. In your book, Mindfulness, Bliss and Beyond, you mentioned that the states of Arakalama practice were passed down from the Buddha Kassapa, but I'm confused on how they were passed down. Was it through devas, etc.? No, the Buddha Kassapa was supposed to be in the same eon. So they said, you know, from teacher to teacher, and it passes down the line, and sometimes we're not quite sure what it really meant, but some of those traditions just do go down the ages. What is the difference between the states of Arakalama practice and jhana versions? In other words, it wasn't the real thing. In the same way, even today, that when, you know, I started teaching jhanas and that finally they started to become popular, and so some famous teachers, I can't say who they are, they started teaching jhana light, L-I-T-E, which wasn't jhana at all. But they wanted to experience jhana and to teach jhana so much, otherwise they were just almost like second-class teachers, not the real thing. So they started teaching jhana light, L-I-T-E, which wasn't real jhana at all, but you can see just how the standards were dropping, even in my lifetime. What was required to actually to be a jhana was much less, or said to be much less by authoritative teachers, but they didn't really know what they were saying. So because of that, you can see that just often the standards go lower, 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 lower. I don't know if any of you know sort of even the German literature, Goethe's Dr. Faustus. And in that particular story, Dr. Faustus begins by being given a PhD in the university. I think it was Frankfurt. But he was born in Frankfurt, or he lived in Frankfurt, Goethe. But anyway, it was Frankfurt. Anyway, Dr. Faustus had a big celebration when he was given a PhD, because they'd only give one PhD maybe every 10 or 15 years. So to get a PhD was really something. And it was celebrated. That was really an amazing achievement. But I don't want to demean your PhDs, but it's much easier these days. The level has actually dropped, simply because, you know, people want more PhDs, and so it's easier to get a PhD now, certainly, than it was, you know, in Dr. Faustus's time. So that's one reason you can see things, standards do drop. That's our world. Standards of politicians, standards of governments. I remember as a kid, I shouldn't really get into politics, but I remember as a kid there was the Minister for Home Affairs in the British government. I forget exactly what his name was now, but he was maybe number three in the government, and he was a very competent person, and people thought that he would one day become the Prime Minister of UK. But his friend, an associate, was involved in a scandal. And immediately that scandal was publicised, this minister resigned immediately. No questions. He said, I don't want sort of the status and the credibility of this office to be even questioned. And after two or three years, when the police finished their report, he had no blemish on his conduct at all. He had done nothing wrong in the slightest of way, except there was an old school friend he knew. And he was such an honest person. His career was ended in that in government. But it was a wonderful example of how to do the right thing. Even the slightest whiff of corruption, he wouldn't try and even defend himself. He'd say, no, the office is more important. So he resigned. And that type of honesty, that type of integrity, you don't see that anymore. The people say, no, no, I didn't do anything. Oh, you prove it. And kicking and screaming, they find out that they are guilty. And then they type of sort of resign. But the damage has been done since then. So standards do drop. Okay, Dr. Ajahn, where is dana found in the Eightfold Path? In the first, the right view, that there is a good result of giving, this good result of respect, that it's not sort of a useless thing. And so that dana, giving, is found in the first part of the Eightfold Path, in the right view. And that's one of the reasons why, that, you know, if I give whatever I can, no serving, I don't have to, I don't get anything out of this, you know, so teaching people. But, you know, we expect, you know, you also to support according to your means as well, so that we can have good retreat centres, good nunneries, good monasteries. So, but we never actually, I never like charging. I know that some people charge and charge, you know, pay this and pay that, and that's just really gross. So, however people want to make dana. And I mentioned one of those dana's to you, that dana when I gave £20 just to an orphanage. Never ever regret that. It's a beautiful little gift, which I could do. And when I had money. And these days, you know, you give, what was it, my dana? It'd be wonderful if somebody actually could find this book, because the first time, one of the first times I went to Singapore, and they took me around to see this, the island and the temples there, and it was actually the Sri Lankan temple, I think it was the Mangala Vihara, but anyway, I could have got the name wrong, but they took me around just, you know, the temple and about the Buddha statue, and the monk, the head monk there asked me to sign a visitor's book, and that's where I made my mistake. Because I took the book and I signed my name, you know, Ajahn Brahm, where from, you know, from Bodhinyana Monastery or Buddhist Society of West Australia in Perth, Australia, whatever. And the next column was, how much you're donating. I picked up the wrong book. It wasn't the visitor's book I picked up, it was a donation book. And I'd already filled the first two columns. And so I thought, oh my goodness, how can I can't sort of cross them out or tear out the page or, you know, what can I do? So thinking on the spot, I wrote down my donation. Just the two words, my life. I thought that was really cool. And that's accurate. What am I giving? My life. I'm not going to disrobe. So don't give me your telephone number. So that's what I've given. So that's my donation. So you know, that's what I donate. So whatever you want to donate, up to you. Anyway, Dana, can you please tell us the Pali terms of the 9th and 10th factors of the path? Oh my goodness, I thought you might. I think it's Vimutti and Vimuttiniana. Some are Vimutti, some are Vimuttiniana, I think. Freedom, liberation, and also the knowledge of liberation. 9th and 10th factors. That's wonderful when people say, oh, you're enlightened, but you don't know it. And the Buddha said, no. If you get enlightened, you know it. Can you please explain how the 6 Abhinya powers manifest when meditators develop the 4th jhanas? Oh, my goodness me. Are they just a natural occurrence in the mind with this degree of stillness and mindfulness? Okay. Sometimes some of the psychic powers you develop to 4th jhana, sometimes you get them after a 1st jhana. But how they manifest is just there for you. Mind has got power. You know, it just, you feel that you have this stuff. But they don't work for everybody. Some people are just not interested in them. They're natural occurrence in the mind. Yeah, they're natural. You don't develop them. They're just there. Well, sometimes you can develop myths of purpose to it, but most of the time not. And it's natural occurrence for mind, this degree of stillness and mindfulness, yeah. Natural occurrence. But you don't sort of stress them. They're like, they're more like the free gift you used to get in the cornflakes packet. You know, you have the cornflakes. I don't know what you have these days in muesli, but sometimes you have free gifts, and it just, you don't buy the cornflakes to get the free gift. You know, the cornflakes or the food, the main course is why you buy those things, and so you meditate to get enlightened, and some of these things happen as a byproduct. What is the difference between the jhana? Oh, amazing! Look at this. The jhana you taught and the light jhana was taught by the Bhagavad teachers, who also claim their teachings come from the sutta. Coming from this, I won't say which particular teachers you have here, but exactly the same question I asked was mentioning earlier. What is the difference? One of the differences is in the real jhanas, you cannot think. You cannot formalize a thought. Say, is this jhana? Or is this the peace and the bliss? You can't do that. The mind is just really, really still. And thought has gone a long time ago. And you're not aware of the body has gone. So those are two very clear qualities of a jhana. The five senses are beyond you. You can't see, hear, smell, taste, or touch. They're just not there anymore. And if somebody sneezes, you can't hear it. Or coughs, they can't hear it either. And if somebody picks you up and puts you somewhere else because they've got to clean the hall after the retreat finishes, you wouldn't feel it. So those are some, but you're perfectly aware of the inner world, the mind. And also, just afterwards, the five hindrances are just gone for long periods of time. You can't just go in those meditations for just a couple of minutes, especially the deeper ones. You're in there for hours. It's just too stable. So because of that, some of the stuff, it doesn't come from the suttas. And sometimes, so be careful with suttas, because sometimes things are lost in translation. Because sometimes people, they criticize me, they say, oh, you just teach Visuddhimagga, commentary jhanas. I said, what are you talking about? I said, well, you know, you mentioned nimittas. I said, yeah, but the nimittas aren't mentioned in the suttas. What are you talking about? There's no mention in, say, Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation of nimitta. Of course, because he translates them as, please excuse me, that thing. And it's in Upakalesa Sutta. In the Upakalesa Sutta, I think it's number 128 or 108, I always get it wrong. So, of the Majjhima Nikaya, Upakalesa Sutta is all about how to develop nimittas and the problems we have with nimittas when they come up. And if you read it in the Pali, nimitta, 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 nimitta. But in the translation, it says, well, if there's a problem with that thing, then you do this and do that. So sometimes you have to be careful that the translation sometimes misses things. So it's there with the nimittas. Anyway, I always found it very inspiring to imagine what it would have been like just before the Buddha's awakening, or just after, as I was going in search of the five ascetics. If you don't mind, could you please tell us the story of how he spent his first 7 weeks after awakening? Telling that story, we think it's impossible. Just sitting and staring at the Bodhi tree for 7 days. It's not possible. But when you get into the jhana realms and samadhi realms and come out afterwards, some of those things are possible. Just like the story of the monk who visited Sydney. And I think I've mentioned that already. Many of you know the story. It's weird, but it happened. That 7:30, just half an hour meditation, followed by the first talk on a Friday evening, or we did it on Thursday evening here because it was Easter time. And he just was meditating, and 8 o'clock he hadn't moved. 9 o'clock, he hadn't come out of his meditation. 9:30, 10 o'clock, he still hadn't moved. He hadn't rung any bell. So what did people do? They went to bed anyway. They didn't wait for the monk to ring the bell. And that's one of the reasons why, that when you hear the house rules, always let the monk go out first before you leave the hall. If he had that rule, they'd have been also in that hall for 7 days, because that's how long he stayed there for. He was meditating there, meditating. He didn't move for 7 days. 7 days, 8 days? 8 days. No food, no drink, no going to the toilet. He just sat there like the Buddha statue, not moving. And after 7 days, 8 days, sorry, he came out of his meditation and said, "I'm sorry, I apologize. I just was in a deep meditation. And, as I say, you forgot to set the clock to come out in time to do your duties." But apparently people said on that retreat, "Wow, wonderful, it was so inspiring." Because all these talks and all these instructions, you get those from YouTube and other books. It wasn't me, it was another monk. You get all that sort of stuff. But to actually to see it, real, actually happening, that's really cool. And don't ask me who it is. So, what would it be like just before or after the Buddha's awakening? You know, one of the weird things, and I don't mind saying this stuff, I'm in a good mood, that if ever you do experience a jhana, say just even first jhana, you'll know that experience, a real first jhana, is exactly how the Buddha felt in a first jhana. This goes beyond the person. The jhana is a state of mind. And whether it's a Buddha or a Devadatta or anyone, Ajahn Chah, with that first jhana, it is the same. Even more so the second jhana, which is one of the reasons why I often say, if you want to find out the four holy places where the Buddha lived, we're not talking about the physical Buddha, you know, the body and the bones and the hair and stuff. We're talking about his mind. That's where he lived. First, second, third, fourth jhana. So if you really want to pay respects to the holy places, the real ones, you don't need to go to India. You go inside. That's where you find the real places where the Buddha hang out. And that's freaky. And you know, when you sort of realize that, it's mostly, you know, described in the Curahatapadopama Sutta, which happened to be the first sutta, the first teaching, which the Arahat Mahinda taught in Sri Lanka. The first teaching. And so it's always an important teaching. I was like, why? Why is that important? But then when you understand it, and if you've ever had a jhana, that was how the Buddha felt. That's freaky, that's goosebump stuff. Ooh. So you understand what it feels like. And so these are big states. They're not just like you get into jhana, okay, that was the first jhana, great. Blows you away. It's big stuff. Anyway, Ajahn Brahm, after meditation you have full energy. Question, how do you manage this full energy, especially at night time, evening meditation? Couldn't sleep till 3 a.m. Thank you. Why do you want to sleep? It's okay if you have really full energy after a deep meditation. You don't need to sleep. What is the purpose of sleep for the brain? You know, if you re-energize and charge, these deep meditations do weird stuff to you. And you're perfectly healthy. And you haven't got, if you can't sleep because insomnia or you're worried about something or you're jet lagged or whatever, it feels totally different. You're tight, you're stressed, you're just, ugh. But if you've got sort of just after a deep meditation, oh, you're just so peaceful, so blissed. relax to the max. You can lay down if you wish. You're just stretching your legs, but you're perfectly mindful and aware. Five hindrances are not there. You just enjoy. And then afterwards, you know, when it wears out, then you can catch up on your sleep. But it's perfectly healthy for you. What role does intention and karma play in the Buddha's view of not eating meat? Even though I have no intention of violence and the meat I eat today is not being killed for me, is buying that meat today sends a signal to the market that increases the slaughter of animals in the future? Can people find fault with me for that? I've read your article on vegetarianism. Yeah, that's out there. I don't know what it's doing over there. But anyway, how do the lay Buddhists relate to this issue? Surely there's a black and white answer that aligns with the Dhamma. No, there's very few black and white answers anywhere in this world. If you can, and if it's healthy for you, fine. But the interesting part was that the Buddha actually had the opportunity to make, especially for the monastic community, to be vegetarian. He was asked by Devadatta, can you please make that a rule, that the monks will only eat vegetarian food? And the Buddha said no. There's a reason for that. And I think maybe the reason was, it's not to tell people what to do, to encourage them, yes, but not to actually to order them. Because this is not so much a thou shalt not religion. Even the precepts, one shall train oneself not to kill any living being. One should train oneself not to steal. One should train oneself. It's a training. It's not a black and white. So I remember this one fellow, and he was an alcoholic. And so during the rains retreat, he made a resolution in front of us all. And he said, I will not drink any alcohol from sunrise to sunset for the 3 months. And you might think that's just a cop-out, but for him, that's a very tough thing for him to do. And, you know, before the sun came up, he made sure he had, you know, a big sort of swig, and he hung out and hung out and hung out and hung out until the evening time when the sun went down and the bottle was already open, just come on, go down quickly, and then he would drink. But he kept his resolution. Now, for that person, that was a very tough and hard thing to do. Maybe later on he could take it further. So, in order to make Buddhism appropriate, available for many, many people, the rule is optional. I get into trouble for that, but that's how I feel. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and why you want to be a nun? Eh? Oh, this is for you, Venerable Nisara. Do you want to answer it now or tomorrow? Tomorrow?
Did you say? I hear you.
Yeah, okay. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and why you want to be a nun? Thank you. This is for Venerable Mu.
Are we going to do it tomorrow?
Well, I don't know if you want to do it tomorrow afternoon. We've got a couple more questions here. Finish off these questions while I've still got the microphone, and then I can hand it to you. While you're answering, I can go to bed. The sutras often mention a special kind of meditation that only arahats could do. Could you please explain what this is about? You wait till you're an arahat and find out for yourself. Do I want to sort of give you all of the... No, well, I think I'm not exactly what it means, but it's more like nothing to do. So it's like that meditation which I did imagining you're the Buddha, but doing it perfectly. Nothing to do, nowhere to go. I have not been married for too long, but I am very unhappy. I want to separate in order to do what's right, so both parties, but afraid of social stigma, etc. How can I look at this situation as a Buddha? Thank you so much. If you haven't been married for so long and you're unhappy, want to separate in order to do what's right,
the best thing to do is become a monk or a nun. That's a very good, holy way to do it. Anyway, that this is the sort of stuff I've got to be very careful, because otherwise, you know, that I get quoted in the divorce proceedings. So sometimes, if you're unhappy, that people know that, but, you know, maybe you can make it happy. I don't know. And I won't go there. Hi, Ajahn, why am I so slow at processing thoughts to replying someone? So fast. Sometimes people are too fast and they give quick answers and that's all wrong. So being slow is wonderful. It means you're very peaceful. It was very difficult for me to meditate. Random thoughts cross my mind every few seconds. I try to focus on my breath in and out, but is there any other technique I can use? Yes, focus on your random thoughts. So you've got random thoughts come every few seconds, so actually you're being mindful of the thing which is right in front of your mind right now. Emperor's three questions. So you've got a random thought, if it's up there, great. That's what you're aware of. And what do? You care for it. Caring for it is not indulging it, nor is it trying to get rid of it. You're caring for it. Just like that you are caring for somebody else's dog while you're away. You care for that dog. You don't own the dog. You don't try and get rid of the dog. You know, it's in your care just for that short period of time. And so that's why you care for the random thoughts. They come in, they're not mine, but you can come in if you want to. And they go out, because when you open the door of your heart, please remember, a door is not just to come in, it's also used to go out. So the door you came in this hall, which door was it you came in? And you go out that door as well. So don't just think opening the door of my heart means that everything keeps coming in. Opening the door of your heart means people things go out again as well. So when you care for things, sometimes they just disappear. They leave. Okay. So, ooh. A proposal. I don't know. This is da-da-da-da-da. Ajahn, thank you for the wonderful teachings. At the end of our physical cycle, death, there are lights, wonderful lights. Should we go into the lights and continue on the karmic wheel, or can we choose to go home, back to the source, and get off the merry-go-round? Back to the source? What source? The only source which I know in this place is tomato sauce. Is that what you mean, go back? Or soy sauce? So, no, it's if you want to get off samsara, you can never get off. If you want to get off. So what do? You stop all wanting. So you're so wanting, you're so still. Get so still, like you vanish, you disappear. And when the buzz comes to take you onto your next life, whether it's in Brahma realms or lower realms, the buzz comes and looks, there's nobody there. So the buzz leaves without you, because you've gone. That means no more rebirth. You missed the bus. Okay, so that's all my questions. So would you like to tell about being a nun? Were it recorded? Recorded? Okay, well, just raise your voice.
Can you
Yeah, okay.
Maybe I'll be able to do this short for once.